a huge number of slides, and I'm going to skip many of them. I just want to join Maria in thanking you for sitting patiently and getting through some of these pretty tough interviews. Okay, so far, the arrow doesn't work. My fault.
That's a bit of preparatory.
So, last lecture, vector value functions. So far we looked at scalar value functions. Now we're going to look at vector value functions, and so our functions are going to take values in maybe R and D, or maybe in a model space. Okay. I'm going to discuss these problems, or perhaps skip over these problems, depending on time constraints, in order of increasing difficulties. First, there will be things that follow immediately from the corresponding scalar results. Then there are results that reduce to the scalar case by a simple trick, which is not obvious, but is simple. Then there are going to be results on vector value functions that require substantial new ideas. And then I thought I would close with unsolved problems, but we have, in fact, a whole session on unsolved problems. So maybe I may skip that this morning. Okay, so in the setup, Y is a Banach space. There's the way we denote its norm. Y star is the dual Banach space. There's the way we denote its norm. Okay. Cm of Rn and Y denotes the space of functions from Rn to Y with continuous and bounded derivatives up to order m, and here's the norm. Okay. All right. Now, for any, for any subset E, Cm of Ey denotes the space of all restrictions to E of functions in Cm of Rny. And so if E is finite, then, of course, those are all functions. And if E is infinite, then probably it doesn't consist. It's highly unlikely to consist of all functions. Okay. And the norm on Cm of Ey is given by what you think it is. It's the nth of the norm of all possible extensions. Okay? All right. And as usual, constants denoted by C will always depend only on little m and little n in the choice of our space. They don't depend on the function f, they don't depend on the set E, and they don't depend on the monospace Y. Okay. Well, suppose that we are given little f and cm of Ey. Then capital F, defined everywhere, is a C optimal extension if it belongs to cm of Rn with values in Y. And it agrees with little f on E, and its norm is as small as possible up to a factor of C. That's the obvious definition. So here are simple formal consequences of results for scalar functions. So first of all, suppose that E is finite. Then in that most Cm log n computer operations, we can compute a list of little subsets of E. So the number, each of these little subsets has at most a bounded number of elements. The total number of little subsets is at most linear in the number of points of E. And furthermore, given a Banach space value function on E, then its norm in Cm of Ey is comparable to the max of the norms of the subproblems. And simply, we use the exact same list of little subsets as in the scalar case. They also work in the vector case. Okay. Linear extension operators of bounded depth. Suppose E is finite, it has 8 points. There is a linear map from Cm of Ey to Cm of Rny. So that, the first box says it's an extension operator. TF agrees with F on E, so it's an extension. And the second box says that the norm of this operator is bounded by a constant depending only on little m and little n. Moreover, T is given by a formula. There's the formula. So TF at a given x is a linear combination of function values at y, where y varies over a little subset of E, and we have coefficients lambda of x, y. So S of x is, of course, contained in E. Lambda of x lambda of x, y, and S of x are independent of F. And the number of points of S is less than or equal to C. So TF of x is determined by the value of F and at most C points. lambdas and s's can be computed efficiently, and the reason is that they are exactly the same lambdas and s's as in the Skipper case. Okay. These results give rise to efficient computation of C optimal extensions as in the Skipper case, and they follow immediately from the corresponding results from the Skipper case, simply because the norm of n vector in y is equal to the sum of the inner product of the vector taken over all dual vectors in the dual unit ball. So let's not go through the details. I promise you it's trivial. Okay, now results that are deduced in the Skipper case by a trick. Now we're going to look at CM and EY, where E is infinite, and we're going to generalize bundles, Glaeser refinements, etc., to the vector value case. First, why should we care? Well, remember this nice problem from real algebraic geometry, the Brenner-Epstein-Monster-Kolar problem. Suppose we have a matrix of polynomials on Rn, and suppose that we then have a vector of polynomials, little f1 through little fi. Then consider the system of equations on the slide for unknown functions, capital F1 through capital Fj. Okay. We ask, or the original question of that laundry list of algebraic geometers was, is there a solution with F1 through Fj continuous? And here's an interesting example due to Hochster for particular reasons. One equation and three unknowns. So which polynomials F, a little f, allow a continuous solution, capital F, capital G, capital H? Okay. Vector value generalizations of our results on bundles, on Glaeser refinements, and all that apply to this problem with continuous replaced by Cn. So the case n equals 0 is the easiest case, but we can also do n. And moreover, the required generalizations of our results on bundles and all that follow easily from the Skipper case by a trick. Okay, so we're first going to set up the vector value version of bundles and Glaeser refinements. Next, it says on the slide, explain the trick. But in fact, I think I'm going to skip over the trick to save time. And then give applications to the Brenner-Epstein-Monster-Kolar problem. Okay, so we fix M, N, and D, and we're going to work at CM of Rn with values in Rd. A little bit of notation. If f belongs to cm of Rn with values in Rd, I can think of it, of course, as a vector of d scalar value functions, and its jet is given as on the slide in the obvious way. Notice that at the moment jx is the mth degree Taylor polynomial, not the m minus first, because we're dealing with infinite sets. Okay, so that means that the jet of a vector value function belongs to the vector space of Rd value polynomials of degree less than or equal to n, which is denoted as you see. Okay, now for fixed x, we have jet multiplication, which, as we've seen I don't know how many times, makes the scalar value polynomials into a ring, which we call R sub x, the ring of m jets at x. Okay, if p is an m jet and q is a vector of m jets, you could just multiply p by q component-wise, and that makes the Rd value polynomials on Rn into a module over the ring of over the ring Rx, and so we're going to call that module Rx to the d. Okay, so roughly 50 years ago, I passed an exam in which I had to know what a module was. So this is, it's relatively recent that I spoke the word again. Okay, all right, now let E be compact. A bundle over E is a family, as shown, where for each x in E, either h of x is an empty set for reasons that we remember, or h of x is a translate, not of an ideal in Rx, but rather an Rx of an Rx submodule in Rx to the D. So the case D equals 1 is the old definition of a bundle, and now vector value version of one is a bundle. Okay. And as in the scalar case, the particular H at one point is called the fiber at the given point. And let's see. All right, I'm going to skip this slide. A vector value function is a section of a bundle if its jet belongs to the fiber at each point of E, same as in the scalar case. And I would like to decide whether a given bundle has a section. as in the scalar case, we're going to answer this question with Glaser refinements. So suppose we have a bundle. Its Glaser refinement is H tilde with fibers A, Roman H tilde, where for each X0 and E, the fiber Roman H tilde of X0 is defined as follows. We fix a large enough integer constant K determined by little n and D, and H tilde of X0 consists of all P0 in the fiber of the original bundle that satisfy the condition in the box. Now, if you look at the condition of the box, it looks very familiar. Okay? It is exactly the same condition as we saw in discussing CF for infinite E in the scalar case, except that all our polynomials are RD valued, and this large integer constant K depends on D as well as on little n and little n. Otherwise, it's just the exact same definition. So there's the notion of the Glaser refinement. And as in the scalar case, there are degenerate cases where we're not 0 to the 0 when we declare that 0 to the 0 is 0. Okay? Once we can Glaser refine, we can make an iterated Glaser refinement, as in the scalar case. Given the bundle to start with, we declare that H0 is the bundle we start with, and then by induction, HL plus 1 is the Glaser refinement of HL, same as in the scalar case. Here's Glaser's lemma. For a large enough integer constant, which now is also depends on D, for a large enough integer constant, the successive Glaser refinements stabilize. And so let's call H L star the stable Glaser refinement. Okay? And as in the scalar case, there is the main theorem, except now it's vector value. So suppose we have a bundle and we pass to its stable Glaser refinement, then H has a section if and only if its stable Glaser refinement has no vector fibers. Okay. Now, as promised, the vector value main theorem follows from the known scalar case by a simple trick, which it says we now explain, but in fact, which we now do not explain. It's in the slides. I don't explain the trick. But I should at least give credit. This is joint work with Kevin. Okay, this concludes our lack of explanation of the simple trick. So now let's return to the algebraic geometry problem. So a simple remark about our notation about CM. So far, CM of Rn consists of functions whose derivatives of order m are continuous and bounded on Rn. That's actually not quite the conventional thing. One standard definition of CM, so that it's actually not a bottom space, is that it consists of all functions on Rn whose derivatives up to order m are continuous, but we impose no growth conditions at infinity. For the problems I'm discussing, the extra problems arising from the confusion, we will ignore any difficulties arising from our passing from one notion of CM to the other, because I promise you these difficulties are minor, so let's forget about them. All right, so here's our version of the Brenner et al. Problem. For simplicity, we'll work with a single linear equation for d unknown functions, although our results apply equally well to systems. So we fix d functions, a1 through ad, on our red, and we study the single equation in the red box. Linear combination of unknown capital Fs is equal to the little f. The capital Fs are unknown functions in CM of Rn, but n is fixed, which means that we are not allowed to lose derivatives. So the usual, there's very interesting work on equations like this going back to the 1960s, let's say C infinity or in CM, which one is allowed to lose derivatives, but now we are not allowed to lose derivatives. All right, so we're going to ask three questions. First, fix arbitrary coefficients on the right-hand side. How can we decide whether there exists a solution, capital F1 through FD, in CM? Question two, now let's suppose that the A's are polynomials. Now, I'm not going to fix little f, but I'm going to suppose that the little f is also a polynomial. And we look at the same equation, and we think about those little f for which the equation admits a CM solution. Those little f form an ideal in the ring of polynomials, and the problem is to exhibit generators. I'm going to skip question three. Okay. Our vector value main theorem on bundles, let us answer question one. examples, building on it, but doing extra work, we can give a complete answer to question two. We don't know the answer to question three. In fact, so far, we don't know the statement of question three. Okay, I'm going to skip all discussion of semi-algebraic sets and functions, and I'm able to do that because I skipped over question three. Okay, so the solution to question one, given arbitrary functions on Rn, how can we decide whether the equation admits a CM solution? You're going to make a bundle. So here's the bundle. So it has fibers over every point of Rn. Oops, Rn isn't compact, so strictly speaking, this doesn't satisfy the definition of bundle, but never mind, that's a minor point. There's a bundle, and what is the fiber? For each point, the fiber consists of all vectors of polynomials, P1 through PD, such that the equation in question holds at the single point, x0. Notice I'm not even saying it holds as jets at a point, just it holds as values at a point. That way I don't even have to assume that the data, the functions A1 through AD on the right-hand side, little f, belong to CM. I just want to know, I mean, they can be arbitrary, I want to know whether there's a CM solution to the problem. So this is a well-defined fiber, and one can check that that H is a bundle, and moreover, one can check that a section of that bundle is precisely a d-tuple of CM functions that satisfy the equation. It's just a matter of verifying, plotting through the definitions. So our equation has a solution if and only if the bundle has a section, and therefore to decide whether the bundle has a section, you compute its stable place of refinement, and then check whether all the fibers are non-empty. End of story. That's the solution to the first problem, to the first of the problems of Brenner, Homster et al. Okay. For the second question, exhibiting generators, so remember that here's the statement of the problem. Given polynomials A1 through AD, we want to find generators for the ideal of polynomials F for which the equation admits a CM solution. I just want to point out that this problem cannot be solved by analysis alone because it asks for generators of an ideal in a polynomial ring. It also can't be solved by algebra alone because it's about CM functions. So we have to make something like a splitting between an analysis problem and an algebra problem. And the way we do that is, well, here's the analysis question. Once we answer it using 99.9% analysis and 0.1% algebra, then we arrive at a question of pure algebra. Okay, so given polynomials, characterize the C infinity functions little f such that the equation admits a solution for fixed m. So for example, let's go back to Hochster's equation. Here it is. Suppose that little f is a C infinity function of x, y, and z. How can we tell whether there is a C0 solution, whether there's a continuous solution, F1, F2, F3. And the answer is there's a continuous solution if and only if the conditions in the box hold. I think I actually mentioned this during the first lecture. That seems like a long time ago. Let's see. It's curious that we're asking only about continuous functions, but the conditions in the box involve derivatives of little f up to order 3. Okay. Passing from Hochster's example to the general case, we have the following result. So, theorem A. Suppose that A1 through AD are polynomials, m is greater than or equal to 0. Then, there is a list of linear partial differential operators that in principle we can compute. In practice, the computations are ghastly. With the following properties. Each one has semi-algebraic coefficients. Oh damn, I should have explained what a semi-algebraic function is. Never mind, this is simplified quickly. But maybe these differential operators have order strictly greater than the m for which we are interested in a CM solution, as in the example I just showed you. Then if you have a function in C infinity, the equation in question admits a CF solution if and only if all of those differential operators annihilate left. So, for example, in Hochster's example, here are the differential operators. Del upper 0 means don't differentiate.
And the linear operators depend on M.
And the linear operators depend on M.
So, in
yes.
Particular, it's not easy to figure out what will happen in the C infinity case.
Correct, and that would be an interesting question. course, if you're interested in the C infinity case, we're allowed to lose derivatives, so maybe earlier technology would be very useful in population analysis.
If it connects to Artin approximation, you have some pretty, you know, like strict, you know, algebraic conditions to be able to make something like this work, so I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. So, right, I have nothing to say about C infinity. Okay, so here are the differential operators, and they look very much like the conditions that I showed you in the previous discussion two minutes ago. Okay, a few words about the proof of theorem A, followed by a few words about its application. In the proof of theorem A, we have to look at bundles and Glaeser refinements and so on, where the bundles in question depend on this function yield left, and we have to analyze how the bundles depend on yield left. I think that's all I should say. Theorem A follows these defined. Okay, apply to theorem A. Once you have, now we want to understand polynomials F, for which the equation has a solution. Theorem A tells us that those are precisely the polynomials that are annihilated by some explicit list of differential operators. Now, if I give you any list of differential operators, the set of polynomials annihilated by those is unlikely to form a module. And therefore, in order to get a module, I make the following definition. Given any list of linear differential operators, not necessarily the ones that arise from theorem A, the script M of those L's is the ideal of all polynomials, F, which have the property that if you multiply F by any other polynomial, that product is annihilated by all the L's. By brute force, that is a module. And the problem is to exhibit generators. Theorem A says that a given F admits a CM solution if and only if it belongs to that module. And so therefore, the question of finding generators for the ideal, et cetera, reduces the following problem of computational algebra. Given linear partial differential operators, compute generators for the ideal. All right, so we solve that. Kevin and I solve that problem, thus answering question two. An amusing special case is the case of a single differential operator in which you simply multiply a function by the characteristic function of a semi-algebraic set, and so then M of L is the ideal of all polynomials that vanish on a semi-algebraic set. So we are actually computing the, in particular, from this special case, we're computing generators for the ideal of all polynomials that vanish on a given semi-algebraic set. Curiously, there was apparently no previous well-known algorithm in the literature. We searched ourselves and didn't find it. We asked experts. They confirmed that it doesn't exist. These people, Safi Eldin, Yang, and Ji, simultaneously found a more efficient algorithm to compute generators for the ideal of polynomials vanishing on a given set. So our algorithm is simpler because we're not experts. Their algorithm is more efficient because they're experts. Okay, so much for questions one and two. And regarding question three, we don't know. Well, I didn't even ask the question. Okay, so enough about semi-algebraic functions, which I didn't define. Let's go to the next topic. Let's see. Is it okay? Let's say if I read 20 of. Okay. Okay. So on to analysis. So I want to talk about selection problems. So first, CM selection problems, then Lipschitz selection problems. So let's fix M, N, and D. We're given a finite set E, and suppose that for each X in E, we're given a convex target, K of X, in RD. So, of course, Pavel spoke about this, I think, was it on Tuesday?
Yes.
Okay. But at the moment, it's CM selection. So a CM selection of this family of targets is a CM map, capital F, from Rn to Rd, such that at each point of E, the value of F lies inside the target assigned to that point. Okay, that's on the slide. So this is one version of the problem of interpolation. In this problem, our function function values are not completely specified, but at each data point of the given an allowed target set in which our function may function value may lie. Okay. If D equals 1 and each target is a single point, then that reduces to the problem of CM interpolation that we discussed before at great length. Okay. So now the problem, given a family of convex targets as above, find a CM selection whose norm is as small as possible up to a factor C, and now C in this discussion is determined by little m, and D. And for this we have a finiteness theorem. We is Arye, Kevin, and me, and the theorem is this. So given m, n, and d, there is a large integer constant k and a large real constant c, both depending only on little m, little n, and d, for which the following holds. Suppose E is a finite set, and for each x in E, let k of x be a given convex set. Suppose that for each little subset S contained in E, that is, for each subset containing at most k points, the subproblem arising from that S has a solution with norm at most 1. That is, for each subset S, there exists a CN selection of the subfamily k of x, where x merely belongs to S, and that selection has norm less than or equal to 1. Okay. If all that is true, then there is a CN selection of the whole family k of x, x and e, and its norm is less than or equal to a constant c. So that's the finiteness theorem. The proof of this result also yields a finiteness theorem for interpolation with constraints. For example, suppose given m and n greater than or equal to 1, there exist constants k and c depending only on little m. For which, if you give me a finite set E and a function and a real valued function f on E, suppose that given any little subset S contained in E with at most k points, suppose that there exists a non-negative interpolant of C on norm at most 1, as in the slide. Then there exists a non-negative CN interpolant for the whole problem, whose CN norm is at most C. And so to prove these results, we adapt ideas from the classical finiteness theorem for CM of Rn. Recall that we worked with sigmas and gammas to prove the classical finiteness theorem. But to study solar spaces, we abandoned the gammas and just looked at the sigmas. Well, for this problem, we abandoned the sigmas and just look at the gammas. The family of gammas is called a shape field if it satisfies various conditions. So for each point x in a finite set E, and for each positive number m, we associate a possibly empty convex set gamma of xm. And it has various properties, the simplest of which is that as m increases, the gamma increases. And I'm not going to go through the whole definition of what we need, but there is a version of our main theorem on gammas and sigmas, in which you erase all the sigmas and make everything depend on the gammas. Maybe one delicate point is that the definition of Whitney T convexity involved only the sigma, not the gamma. So one has to rethink that. But there is a finiteness theorem for shape fields, a shape field being a set of gammas satisfying all those conditions. And both the finiteness theorem for CM selection and the finiteness theorem for non-negative CM interpolation follow from this general theorem about shape fields. So that general theorem about shape fields is the analog of the main theorem about sigmas and gammas from before. Okay, well, that's nice. So we have gained something in generality. Yes, we've gained something in generality in passing from interpolation problems to selection problems, but we have lost plenty. For shape fields, we have a finiteness theorem, but not a refined finiteness theorem. It which there's a fixed finite set of little jets. We don't have a linear extension operator. I wonder if the very idea of a linear extension operator in this context is ridiculous. And most seriously of all, at least in my opinion, we can't compute anything. The simplest computational problems are I really don't know anything about. So in fact, maybe I will skip over this both to save time and also because there's going to be an afternoon problem session. Maybe that's the right place to state this. Lipschitz selection, Pavel spoke about it. So far we've studied functions defined on Rn. Now I'd like to talk about functions defined on arbitrary metric space. So here's the setup. Let's not try to make it as general as possible. So we fix some positive integer capital D. We're given a metric space. For each point of the metric space, we're given a compact convex target. Okay, a selection of this family of targets is a map, capital F, from X into RD, whose value at each point belongs to the corresponding target. So that's a selection. We're interested in Lipschitz selections, and those are simply Lipschitz functions that are selections. Thank you. Okay, so the problem is to find them. There is a finiteness theorem for Lipschitz selection, long solved and finally relatively recently attained. So given a metric space, given a positive integer D, given a family of convex targets as above, the following holds. Suppose that for any subset of X with at most 2 to the D points, there exists a Lipschitz selection for just those points, the points in S. So there exists a function F super S, mapping S into RD with Lipschitz constant less than or equal to 1, such that Fs of X is in K of X for all X in S. Okay. So that's the hypothesis of the typical finiteness theorem. And the conclusion is that there exists an F taking X into RD with Lipschitz constant at most C depending only on D. So there exists an F with Lipschitz constant of both C of D such that it lands in all the targets. F of X belongs to K of X for all X in D. And for all X in the metric space capital X. That's the theorem. So the result actually holds more generally. As Pavel mentioned before, X can be a pseudo-metric space. That is, you can generalize the definition of a metric so that the distance between X and Y can be zero or infinity. I won't do that. Also, instead of taking the targets sitting inside RD, we can fix a Banach space and assume that each K of X is contained in its own personal d-dimensional affine subspace of Y. In that case, we have to replace 2 to the d by 2 to the d plus 1. And these numbers, 2 to the d and 2 to the d plus 1, in the two flavors of the theorem, are best possible. If the metric space is finite, we need to assume that the convex sets are compact. Okay, now let's see. let me just remind you that a variant of a special case of the finiteness theorem for Lipschitz selection was the crucial ingredient in the original work of Grudny and Schwarzman on C2 and on C1 with modulus of continuity omega. But today we're going to reverse the order of things and we're going to use ideas from the study of CM in order to attack Lipschitz selection. sketch the proof. There are four main steps. Okay, so the first step is to prove the result that we want from a special case in which XD is a metric tree. And I will remind you or tell you or whatever what a metric tree is in a minute. We're actually not going, in step one, we're not going to worry about the sharp constant 2 to the D. We're just going to get a result for a finiteness constant that depends only on D. So that's step one. Then once we do that, we're going to use our results on metric trees to study general metric spaces. And for each X, for each point of the metric space, we're going to define a core, K star, contained in K of X, such that, well, first of all, it's not empty. And secondly, the Hausdorff distance between K star of X and K star of Y for any two points is bounded by a multiple of the distance between them. Okay, so I should have said this core is also convex. So once you do that, you're in very good shape. There are different ways to do that. Pavel explained the other day a very efficient way to do that if capital D equals 2, if our convex sets lie in the plane. I'm going to show you a method that is a simplified version of something that Pavel has been holding up his sleeve for a long time that works for general D. And proper credit, I should mention that Alex Bruni has a simple alternative method of carrying out step two. Okay. Now, once we've done that, we then define a selection. And the way we do that is that we define our selection f of x to be the Steiner point of the core. And I'll actually say what the Steiner point is. Once we have that, we will have proven the finiteness theorem for Lipschitz selection, except that the sharp finiteness constant 2 to the d is replaced by a large constant not very well controlled, depending only on capital D. And so step four is to obtain the sharp finiteness constant 2 to the d, wrapping the thing up. So those are the four steps in the proof. Okay, so let's briefly explain each of the four steps. So first of all, what is a metric tree? Here's a picture of a metric tree. First of all, the red dots are the vertices of the tree, and the blue line segments are the edges of a tree. So far it's not a metric tree, it's just a tree. The edges are denoted by the letter E. But now suppose that I assign a length, a positive length, to each edge of this tree. Let's call that delta of E. And then for any two points, let's say X and Y in the tree, there is a unique non-redundant path from X to Y, traversing through, zipping through the tree. So for example, to get from X to Y in this picture, you go along edge E1 to a red dot, then along E2 to another red dot, then along E3 to the next red dot, then along E4, then along E5. You could take detours and visit other red dots, but that would be redundant. And the distance between X and Y is defined to be the sum of the lengths assigned to the edges used in traversing going from X to Y without detours. Okay, that's a metric tree. Okay, so we want to prove the finiteness theorem for metric trees. Now there's a surprise. Metric trees for this problem can be treated like Rn. That's very weird. Rn has very nice, simple. Well, we are familiar with the geometry of Rn, and we know perfectly well that metric trees are very, 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 very different from Rn. The number, typically, in very simple, plain vanilla examples, the number of dots in a ball of radius r grows exponentially with r, whereas that never happens in Euclidean space. The volume of the ball in Euclidean space is only a power of r. Nevertheless, there is one crucial property that metric trees share with Rn, and for the purposes of this problem, that's enough. So here's the crucial property of Rn. Given a length scale s, we can partition Rn into cubes, q nu, of diameter s, so that at most a bounded number of those q nu intersect any given ball of radius a small multiple of s. Okay. That crucial property of Rn lets us define colorizing decomposition, sweeping partitions of unity, and all the good stuff that we'd like to do. A similar property holds for metric trees. There is a bit of jargon which says that metric trees have Nagata dimension 1, or Asmani Nagata dimension 1. Here's the statement. So suppose we have a metric tree. Given any length scale, the metric space can be partitioned into sets Q nu of diameter less than or equal to S, such that any ball of radius S over 16 meets at most 2 of the Q nu. I think that's really surprising, but there is an elementary proof which I have no time to show you. And I have also no time to discuss how to adapt the proof of our finiteness theorems from Rn to a metric tree. But this key property that I just described for metric trees is enough to adapt the Rn technology that we've been discussing and to prove a finiteness theorem for Lipschitz selection for metric trees. Okay, so that's step one. Okay, step two, defining the core. Given metric space XD, so we're given a metric space XD, and we're given a compact convex target for each X and E, I want to define a core. Well, I will only be able to define a core if the hypothesis of the finiteness theorem holds. So remember the hypothesis of the finiteness theorem. So K is some large positive integer constant depending on D. And we suppose that for any K-point subset S, there is a selection F super S function from S into RD, which takes values in the correct targets and is Lipschitz continuous with Lipschitz constant 1, but this only holds for all X and Y in this limit set S. That's the hypothesis. And under that hypothesis, I want to define a core. Okay, so for each point of the metric space, we're going to define a non-empty convex core, A star, so that the Hausdorff distance satisfies the inequality in the green box. So to do so, we're going to use our result from metric trees. Here's how that works. Let's let T be any tree. We don't yet have a metric on it. We're going to make maps, phi, from T into X. Now, we would be happy if T is 1 to 1, but that's a little too strong. All we need is that if two distinct nodes of T are joined by an edge, then their images are distinct. Okay, so of course that's much weaker than being 1 to 1. I'm going to call such a phi admissible. Okay, if phi is admissible, we can assign a length to each edge of the tree by saying that that the length of the edge is simply equal to the distance in the metric space between the image of one of its endpoints and the image of the other endpoint. Okay? And the reason that the map phi is supposed to be admissible is that then this length is positive. Okay, well, so those delta v define a metric on the tree T. Let's call that metric D sub phi. So now we have a metric on the tree. Okay, so here's a little example. Notice, I've specified what the map phi is doing to three points. And notice that the map is not 1 to 1, but at least so far, it looks invisible. Okay. All right. Now we can pull back our Lipschitz selection problem from the metric space X to the tree just by setting, let's say, K sub phi of the node T to be equal to the target assigned to the image of T under the map phi. So we can pull back the Lipschitz selection problem. And you can check that the hypothesis of the finiteness theorem holds for that pullback problem on a metric tree. Aha, we have proven the finiteness theorem on the metric tree, and therefore, by step one, and therefore there exists a map capital F from the nodes of the tree into RD with the properties in the box. So F of T belongs to the target, the pullback target for each T and T, and furthermore, it's Lipschitz with respect to the pullback metric on the tree. Okay, so let's call an F like that an admissible selection of T phi. Notice, Notice that there's this constant C of D in the green box. We fix that constant once and for all. And with that choice of a constant, this is the definition of an admissible selection. And F with those properties is an admissible selection. So admissible selections exist whenever T is a tree and phi is an admissible map from the nodes of T to the metric space X. Okay. Now, suppose we pick a base point in T and a base point in X. And let's assume that the admissible map phi takes the base point in T to the base point in X. Then we define the orbit. We use the word orbit. There's no group action, but we use the word orbit. NASA also uses the word orbit without any obvious group action. So we define the orbit associated to the tree T, the map phi, the two base points T0 and X0. The orbit is the set of all values at the base point T0 of admissible selections for T phi. Okay? That was a long, complicated sounding definition, but it's certain, but it's at least elementary. Okay. Now, thanks to step one, we know that the orbit is always non-empty. The core is defined to be the intersection of these orbits over all possible choices of the tree T, the admissible map phi, and base points T0 that map to the chosen X0. So the intersection of a lot of these orbits is defined to be the core. One can easily check that the core is convex. One can easily check that the core is compact and possibly empty. One can check. One can check that the core is non-empty by doing the following. We want to show that the intersection of a lot of orbits is non-empty. Each orbit comes from a metric tree. Because by compactness, it's enough to look at an arbitrarily large finite collection of metric trees. Out of these metric trees, we somehow glue them together, and we make one great big metric tree. We apply to that one great big metric tree step one, there is a Lipschitz selection. It follows that the intersection over these orbits of finitely many metric trees is not empty, and so by compactness we're done. Okay, and by an argument in a similar spirit, by creating new trees out of gold and applying what we know from step one, one can prove that the Hausdorff distance from the core associated to X to the core associated to Y is less than or equal to a constant times the distance from X to Y. So we're done with defining core, but well, we're done with that step. Okay, so let's declare victory over step two. All right, step three, the Steiner point. All right, well, when Paolo and I started working together on this, I didn't know what the Steiner point is. I don't know whether you know what the Steiner point is. Let me explain. So suppose that K is a compact convex set in RD. For any positive number R, let KR be the set of points that lie within distance r of a set k, right? So as r grows, k sub r grows. And for enormous r, it looks almost like a large ball. Okay, let v sub r denote the center of mass of k sub r. It turns out that as r tends to infinity, v sub r tends to a limit that I'm going to call v sub infinity. And v sub infinity belongs to K, the original convex set. So V sub infinity is called the Steiner point of K. Okay, a standard fact from convex geometry is as follows. Suppose you have two compact convex sets with Steiner points K and K prime respectively. The distance between their Steiner points is less than or equal to some constant depending only on the dimension times the Hausdorff distance between the two compact convex sets K and K prime. So C of D depends only on D. In fact, one actually knows the sharp value of C of D. We won't need that. Okay, so that's a standard, very interesting fact of convex geometry. That's something of a miracle. Here's a little elementary example to show that the center of mass could not be used in place of the Steiner point. Look at the blue triangle and the red triangle. Their Hausdorff distance is negligibly small, but their centers of mass are not close together. So the center of mass does not have this property, but the Steiner point does. That's very useful. Okay. So now, as an application to Lipschitz selection, suppose we're given a metric space. We're given a compact convex set target k of x for each point. We have defined the core in the previous step. And so we know that each of these k's should be k stars. We know that each k star of x is a non-empty convex set. We know that their Hausdorff distance is less than or equal to a constant times the we know this inequality from step two, right? That's what that's part of what the core does. Again, there should be asterisks on the k's. Okay, well, now let's define our selection f of x to be the Steiner point of k of the core k star. So for each x, f of x is then an element of k star, which was a subset of k. So fortunately, our selection lands where it should. F of x does belong to k of x. It is a selection. It's a Hausdorff, a Lipschitz selection, because the distance from f of x to f of y is less than a constant times the Hausdorff distance from the core at x to the core at y, and that in turn is less than or equal to a constant times the distance from x to y, either the defining properties of the core. And so we have a Lipschitz selection. So victory over step three. So everything is done except for the sharp value of the finiteness constant to get from some large integer constant k to 2 to the d. Oh, by the way, in the variant of the finiteness theorem, which Rd is replaced by a bottom space y, we can't use the Steiner point, and Pavel has a construction of something that equals the Steiner type point. Okay. Anyway, all right, so now how are we going to get the sharp finiteness constant? Let me just say in very few words, and then end. So let's see.